This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.starktruthradio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Nicholas Hausdorff. He writes for The Jacobite. Nicholas, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, great talking to you, man.
How long have you been writing for Jacobite?
I don't know, man. Since, I don't know, a couple of months. Sorry, man. How about, like, who are you actually, man? Sorry. Who are you and what's your radio and why do you want to talk to me?
Okay, so I was interested in your views. Actually, a friend of mine on Facebook suggested I interview you, and the general themes, the themes of dissident politics and how they overlap. And how they relate to the direction that we're going, and also a major interest of mine is aesthetics and how it relates to politics, and that's something that you you post a lot about on Twitter, and you have the book Superstructural Berlin.
Yeah. All right, fair enough.
And the site of Jacobite, there's a general dark enlightenment theme. So I kind of relate to what you said. I was listening to the interview you did with that guy from Zero Books, and that's more of a Marxist site, which they published Superstructural Berlin.
Yeah.
And it was interesting what you said is that. About the kind of the dark enlightenment, because I kind of identify with this as well, because I don't consider myself to be a dark enlightenment or right wing. I would say I have a more fairly eclectic views that combine elements of both, like the dissident right and the dissident left. But I feel that if you have eclectic political views, you're kind of forced to align yourself more with that kind of scene, if you want to call it the dark enlightenment or dissident right, because all other political movements, whether it's the left or mainstream conservatism, they demand a lot more orthodoxy. So I kind of do see that scene as playing a role for people with eclectic views.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I agree. I mean, basically, that was the theme of the interview with Doug Lane, that, you know, that weasel, man. I mean, did you listen to the whole version, or did you listen to his version of it?
The whole version? I listened to the version that was posted on the Zero Books website.
All right, okay, yeah. Because basically Doug, he, you know, like, is really interesting. For me, that was a learning experience, you know, because, you know, I sort of counter-recorded the interview, and, you know, Doug, you know, he cut a lot of it out. You know, like, it sort of changed the mood of the interview. It's a really interesting learning experience. Like, he cut out every time I laughed, which I found that really interesting. Huh. Like, just as a setting of tone, you know, like, how do you, you know, how you portray someone, and, you know, that was really interesting. And also what he cut out was, like, the whole, like, synthesis of the interview, like, the stuff that we agreed on, and I think that was... He was afraid to show this to his listeners.
I totally relate to that, because I mean, I have a lot of views that overlap with the left, but a lot of leftists, even if your views overlap with them, if they put you in this category, they don't want to talk to you. So, I mean, that's a big issue with them. So what issues do you still agree with the left on?
Well, man, I mean, that's problematic. And, you know, like I try to say that, I keep saying that, like, these notions, they don't make sense anymore. You know, like, those are like, you know, basically propaganda, political battle notions, you know, like, and everybody understands something different. You know, when you say left or right, you know, like a real leftist will not identify with this, like, mainstream liberal discourse. And, you know, like, right wing is also like that has spread out so far. So, like, this is not gonna, you know, add to any meaningful debate if you keep, like, sort of using these things, you know, and yet we do use them, you know, like, and I remember, like, Doug called me a reactionary, and I was like, yeah, right, I never thought about it in this way, but, you know, like, I mean, whatever you want to call me, you know, like, yeah, I mean, I'm fine with that, you know, if it adds to the edginess or whatever, you know. So I can't say, like, to make it short, like, I can't say, like, what I agree on with the left, because, you know, like, that's a difficult thing to talk about. Like, what is the left, you know? And in general, I would say that perhaps, like, a left-wing sensibility today, you know, that perhaps can best be described is that you have some sort of sympathy with people, you know, and that you're not, you know, like, you know, abstracting everything to the end, but, you know, like, that you actually make a general effort of liking people. And you know, like, if you're really honest about that already, that's not easy, you know, like, because people are fucking ugly, you know, like, I mean, you really have to force yourself to like them, you know.
Huh. Yeah, for sure. You wrote the book Superstructural Berlin, which was published by Zero Books. Are you a Berlin native?
No, I'm not a Berlin native, but I've spent a lot of time in Berlin. Like, I've lived there for 5 years, and that's a really, really interesting city. I mean, like, that is a city that, you know, like, it'll touch your soul, you know. It's built on a swamp, you know, like, it's been completely traumatized and bombed, and, you know, like, it's like a huge hub for, I don't know, like, perhaps demoralization. I had this really interview with Jason Horsley about that.
Oh, I interviewed him as well a while back.
Yeah. I think he's a really interesting guy, and I think he's like a true, you know, like, outsider and underground artist. So, like, I you know, like, I hope your listeners will check him out. Like, I really sympathize with him, because I think he has like an honest project, but, you know, of course he's writing about the stuff, you know, that will, you know, never allow him to get like any meaningful exposure, you know, like, that's just not going to happen. Like, I tried to wrote a book review, you know, for him, for his book Prisoner of Infinity, for the Hong Kong Review of Books, and that it was so ridiculous, you know, like, they wouldn't publish it for a while, and then in the end they did, so, because it was too problematic, you know, like, Jason was, I don't know, like, a right-winger, or I don't even know what, I mean, it's just, it shows you, like, the difficulties, and that's, like, this, you know, like, the Hong Kong Review of Books, you know, like, they you know, like, that's, like, a medium, or not even medium range, you know, like, they have such a small, you know, that's, you would expect that not to be like an overtly political organization, and yet, you know, like, by the way people, you know, like, perceive themselves and are, like, careful these days, you know, like, they have to they're making so many concessions that they're not even using, like, their small size, you know, like, and I don't really like that. I mean, you know, look, you know, for example, like, myself, like, as a writer, I don't exist, so I can say certain things that other people can't say, you know, and that's interesting, you know, like, you know, nobody gives a shit what I think or what I write, you know, so I don't have a pressure, you know, like, on me, you know, so that, you know, that's a good thing, you know, like, that's what the whole internet lives off, you know, like, it's sort of like a network of distribution, you know, and people edge each other on, you know, like, and this way you sort of distribute responsibility, you know, and that's how you have to think about it, you know, and this way it can't be controlled, you know, because this way you'd have to shut up everybody, and that's too costly as a censorship thing, you know. although that's going to happen, you know, I think that's precisely what people didn't predict as sort of network effects, you know, like you can always cut like big people out on Twitter, but you know, like it gets difficult, you know, if you try to sort of cut everyone out, you know, then this way you sort of make yourself the enemy of everybody, you know. And I think that's something, and you know, like the one of those like sort of, you know, surprising effects of technology that nobody really would anticipate, you know, like, and if you think about it, they had like sort of network idea meme trackers, like I was writing about that stuff in like 2010, you know, so that has been existing for a long time, you know, that they sort of track the distribution and spread of ideas online, you know.
Also in that interview, you did bring up some interesting things about economics. And yeah. Some people are just on both the left and the right. You get the people advocate for pure socialism or pure capitalism. And interesting point you made is you made the point that a lot of right-wingers blame Venezuela's collapse purely on socialism, but you also said, a very simplistic view. There's a lot of factors.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, the problem is, like, here's the problem, and that's, I think that's a particularly an American problem. It's a wider Western problem, but it's particularly an American problem. You know, Americans grow up, they don't know anything about the world, so, like, they have, their big problem is they have a very limited understanding of geopolitics, you know, like, and geopolitics is, like, an extremely determining factor of international economics. You know, like you cut that out, you risk to understand nothing. You know, like the economy, you also have to understand sort of what is parapolitics, you know, what is economic warfare, like, you know, like how does the international, you know, currency system works, you know, like how is like economy backed by military force, you know. I'm not saying that's all like economic production is military force, and like part of what China does is like, you know, like get the technological edge that will translate into like superior military technology, and then they can do what the Americans do, you know. Like, I mean, I was talking about this with Doug Lane, and he sort of, you know, like he doesn't take this factor into account at all. Like, I think it's mainly because he doesn't understand it, you know, like, or he has never dealt with it. But, you know, it explains, for example, like the significance of Russia in the world today, you know, which like economically they wouldn't have that significance at all, and yet, you know, like just by their military force, you know, they're still like the, you know, like main actor in international politics today. You know, it's just because they produce superior weapons, and they do until this day. And that's like purely a technological geopolitical factor, you know. So I think if people don't understand this, and you know, that's unfortunately, that seems to be like an American flaw. And I think partly that is because, you know, like America is all about geopolitics. It's all about its, you know, like foreign relations, and you know, like sort of these people who actually use America or abuse America for their own foreign policy goals. You know, because a lot of this type, you know, like these things, they tie together internationally. Geopolitics or foreign policy in general is like that. You know, like that concentration of everything. It's like this small interface, you know, and because it's a small interface, you know, like so many deals are struck there, and that's why it's so important to understand it, you know. And it's also something that's completely esoteric. You're not going to read about it, you know, like it's difficult to understand. You need to like sort of understand like diplomacy and you need to understand gestures, and if you don't take these things into account, you know, you risk understanding nothing, you know, like. And a lot of people in, you know, like philosophy don't get it. Like there's really good philosophers who get it. Like, for example, like Baudrillard, you know, like it's fantastic to read him, you know. And I think the reason why he's very appreciated, you know, like especially on the right as well, is that he seems to understand these things, and, you know, he doesn't write overtly about it, but he writes sort of, you know, in an esoteric way. And that's like another key, like to understanding things, is to read writers and like understand what they're saying, like understand them esoterically, you know, like look at, you know, like what do these words mean, what are people hinting at, what are the things people can't say, you know. Like if you read my Jacobite text, you know, like you're gonna understand them, you know, a lot better if you read them this way, you know.
Do you view nationalism as a rebellion against American imperialism and neoliberalism?
Well, I mean, yeah, partly it's that. I mean, you know, like, I mean, not necessarily as a rebellion, because I mean, Donald Trump to me is the same thing, you know, like that's like sort of a rebellion against the inside, from the inside, you know, like that's, I mean, what he does is he's a New York real estate salesman, you know, like, so he says one thing and, you know, like sort of he covertly does, you know, like a lot of other things, and he gets a lot of stuff done, you know, that people don't see. Like, in a way, he's really the best advertising to what an enlightened autocrat would do, you know. And I find that extremely interesting, like that has nothing to do with democracy. Like, democracy is just like, it has become this ridiculous just like communications game, you know, like, and we don't, you know, it's really, really, you know, difficult to know how much of that is like actual force. And I think there's a lot of guesswork involved, you know, and it's mainly communication, you know. If that makes any sense, I'm saying a lot of things here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely in the case of Trump, as far as on an international scale, you do see these rising kind of a nationalist backlash. So, I mean, this could be the context of European nationalism. But you could also make the case for a lot of like movements in the Middle East. So, like one example is the destruction of Gaddafi's Libya, which was destroyed. So there is this kind of a backlash against American imperialism and neoliberalism.
I think that's really interesting to take into account. You know, like that exactly what you're saying. Like, because like the Americans like have tried to destroy Arab nationalism, you know, like, and of course the question is like, why are they trying to destroy every Arab nation, you know? And of course that has something to do with the nature of nationalism, because nationalism is like, I said that once before, I think nationalism is anarchism for grown-ups, you know, like it's anarchism, you know, or decentralization on a sustainable polity level. You know, because the problem with anarchism is usually, you know, you don't know what the polity is, and the polity is too vague, and, you know, it's not persistent enough, and nationalism is a sort of glue that can make a polity sort of sustainable. You know, it gives you borders, it gives you a reasonable size, you know, like, because we're dealing with huge techno-industrial complexes here, you know, like, you can't, like, build that on an extremely small scale, so you need sort of this medium level, and then you can have some sort of meaningful decentralization, you know. So that's an interesting thing itself. But of course, like, nationalism has this bad rep, but that's mainly because, you know, like, it you know, you're dealing with propaganda history, and people look at history as like this, oh yeah, the world wars happened because of nationalism, you know, which is like, that's such a dubious assertion, you know. It's like this like sort of childish idea that, you know, like, people are sort of inertly racist and riled up against each other, you know, like, and this is why they're slaughtering each other as nations. But you don't look at sort of, you know, like, what does that have to do with mass communications, propaganda apparatuses that get people riled up and that still exist, you know, like, I think that's a real problem. And sort of like the interests, and I mean, a lot of, you know, like, competition from the world wars is like, you know, like sort of these big nations, like, looking at their imperialist interests, you know, like, and they start clashing, you know, like, and this is when you start having war, you know.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, if you go back in history, World War One was a clash of these empires: the British Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburgs. And today, I mean, the rise in nationalism is a backlash against these big institutions. So in the United States is this massive imperial structure. In Europe, they have the European Union. And the problem in the Middle East is this kind of a pan-Islamic agenda taking over the sovereignty of smaller nations like Syria. So nationalism today is about decentralization. And the same case could be made for the elites. So the leftist view has traditionally been that egalitarianism is a solution to oligarchy, but attempts to implement egalitarianism, even if they're well-meant, can lead to a consolidation of power. So you touched on this in an interview, but I totally agree with this. So I think the goal should be to have an elite that's as decentralized as possible. So, and we're starting to actually see that to some degree. I mean, the elite is consolidating its power, But with I do think that Trump has caused some degree of divisiveness among the elites, which is a positive trend.
Yeah. I totally agree with these things. Like, I mean, I think you really have to look at it as an engineering problem, and I think people always have. You know, like I think that that's, you know, if you look at constitutional debates, that's usually okay. Like, we you know, like there will be will to power, but how do we set it up, sort of that so that it, you know, like works in contradictory ways, and like that it sort of. There is some decentralization, and you know, like, I mean, that's also like you. I think you always have to look at things like historically, like what does nationalism mean today, and you know, like that's not necessarily the same thing it meant, you know, like at another time, you know, like and if it's a system that's national, and you know, it becomes sort of sclerotic and calcified as, you know, power, then you probably have to look at something else, you know. But that is the dialectic of history, you know, sort of. And, you know, like, I think there's already signs of, like, the elites moving into a nationalist framework, and I think that's becoming problematic, you know, like, and, you know, I think it's interesting to think about politics in a way of, you know, like, in an aesthetical way, because, like, sort of certain aesthetics, they carry a lot more than is on the surface. And, you know, on the other hand, like, I think there are people already like trying to make this thing only about aesthetics. And I think, you know, like when people are talking about the left, I don't think they understand, like they look at this as sort of this autonomous movement, but this movement has been prepared sort of, and people have been granted like this voice in society. Like if you look at these idiot like parliamentarians or idiot people from NGOs, you always have to think about who enables them, you know, like who are the people like who are giving them a voice, you know, because these people are useless, you know, they're sort of these useful idiot types, you know. And I think that the useful idiot, that's an important like sort of persona to understand in politics. Like, and what that means precisely is that that's somebody who can't map the totality of power relations around him, you know, can only like see very limited aspects of power. And this way people sort of, they don't understand their own position and whose interests they're working for. So they're sort of, you know, like honestly working on their political agenda. But the problem is they only understand political relations or power relations in a partial way. And this is why they become these like weird, you know, like people who are like usually not talented at all, and then people get this idea, okay, you know, like we're completely governed by idiots, you know, which I don't think that's very adequate, you know. Like if you talk to the right people in politics, if you talk to the right people in finance, you know, they're usually very, very interesting and very intelligent people who think in long, you know, like long years and you know, like they're sort of long distance thinkers, and it's very clear, like that other people will implement things for them that they never know they do, you know.
And with these kind of labels, like I admit, I fall into this trap. I think that describing something as right wing or left wing, because it's an easy thing to do because it's so simple, but it's intellectually shallow because it's a way to avoid explaining the real power dynamics. And even what people mean, people can mean different things. So to some people, left-wing can mean like the labor movement, but to others, left-wing can mean the establishment, like the basically like the Silicon Valley and the whole like exactly. George Soros. Yeah. And same with the right. Right-wing can mean nationalism and populism, but right-wing can also mean like a corporate plutocratic agenda. So I think people need to really explain, but the thing is, like, if someone's having a conversation and they have a limited amount of time, it's just, I do this, of course, myself, it's just easy to fall into these labels.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And but I mean, it's real problematic because, you know, like, there is, it creates a lot of, you know, conceptual confusion, you know, and I think, you know, a lot of these, you know, a lot of the arguing is well, I mean, I don't know if it's unnecessary. I think it's important to say today, you know, that your right wing is just so, you know, people can't, you know, like force you along, you know, like they can force you to, you know, like you have to accept the labels that other people put on you, you know, like so that, because that takes away their power, you know, because if you're trying to duck away from this right wing label, you know, you're never going to make any progress, you know? Like, I mean, I personally, I don't give a shit about this, you know? Like, I consider myself an anti-imperialist, and that's my main, like, I'm anti-imperialistic, and I'd say, like, I have certain interests in, like, aesthetics, you know, like, that that I think is extremely interesting, because, like, especially, you know, like, you know, part of the idea of, like, writing a book like Superstructural Berlin, which is, like, that's an experimental sociology, you know, it's, like, to, you go into these cities and you have to understand what they imply, you know, like, and I think that's really important, and certain aesthetics imply certain things, and a lot of what people, you know, like, the sort of aesthetics we're dealing with today, you know, like, I think that, you know, if you really look at this, you know, if you walk from Rome into, like, some, like, a city like Birmingham or something, you know, that's just, like, that's entirely demoralizing, you know, and I think that's really interesting, like, the new urbanists around, like James Howard Kunstler and Leon Krier, they did a lot of good work on that, you know, like, and they were these, like, sort of figures, like, sort of, you know, dissidents of form, you know, that if, you know, they were existing or not existing in their small circles, and they've consistently said these things, you know, like, but they were just, like, completely swept under the rug, because, you know, we're just emerging from a sort of century of mass communications and propaganda where you could just, like, you know, create this sort of mass mainstream culture, like, that exact thing that is falling apart now. And I think, you know, like, what any reasonable person will do today is to think about, how can we, you know, like, make that fall apart without playing into the hands of, you know, these people who are already in power, and who like, their only way out is sort of to create a sort of chaos and to create a sort of civil war situation. And I think, you know, like, nobody can really be interested in that, you know, because, like, that, you know, like, everybody will suffer from that. That's easily started, you know, but you can't end that. And, you know, that always ends up very, very badly, you know. If you look at Yugoslavia or something, you know, these people have just lost, you know, like, and so I don't think, you know, I was talking about this with Doug Lane, you know, like, and especially in the longer version of the interview, you know, like, and you know, like, he was asking about the ethno state, but then, you know, sort of in his interview he just cut that off, and I think that's a really important discussion, you know, but it's also like you know, like, a discussion that, you know, there are some sensible points in that, you know, like, in the terms of, you know, of course, like, people can't be made to, you know, like, to feel ashamed for being white, but that you can't build an ethno state in the U.S. or something, you know, that's completely absurd, you know. At what cost, you know, like, I mean, what do you want to do, like, that's completely absurd, and that people talk about these things, like, I find that really worrying, you know, like, I mean, because that, I can sort of understand the position they come from and the frustration they emerge from, but it's, like, it's absolutely, you know, and it's not politically serious, you know, and that's why these people get a voice too, you know, like, because, like, people who are politically serious, you know, they're usually marginalized as fuck, you know, like, you wouldn't hear about them, you know. Somebody says something sensible about politics, you know, I mean, good chance you won't know them, you know.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing with ethno-state is, I mean, that's something that the American alt-right, a lot of them are advocating. And in Europe, but that's the problem with that, is it kind of revolves, it's a sort of a mass online movement. It's not based on the actual people who live in the area. So I'm not talking about it in moralistic terms. I'm just talking about it in practical terms. You have all these secessionist movements in Europe, from the Catalan movement in Spain, which is more left-leaning, to the Flemish secessionist movement in Belgium, like Vlaams Belang, which is more right-wing. But those movements are based more, they're more organic, because they're based on people who are rooted in that area and have a culture that goes way back.
Yeah, well, I mean, organic is a difficult thing, you know, like, as organic as, like, you know, like, I think it's really, like, interesting. It's a really interesting question to discuss, you know, like, what organic means in these terms, you know, because, like, they have certain, the Catalans, they have certain, like, you know, they have a lot of cultural grievances towards the Spanish, you know, but that movement also has been manufactured, you know, like, that's in you know, like, that it is there and it is not there, you know, like, you can sort of exacerbate certain things by funding them, and that is what happened a lot in the 90s, you know, with these like U.S. institutions that, like, especially in Eastern Europe, you know, Eastern Europe is a really interesting case where they sort of, like, you know, promoted nationalist movements, and it's of course, you know, like to sort of, you know, break that region up and sustainably take it away from the Russian sphere of influence, you know. So what you have in Eastern Europe now are all these like ultra-nationalist sort of movements in, I don't know, like from Ukraine to the Baltic states, you know, and they're all, they sort of, they identify with, you know, like a lot of stuff that is sort of a racist, like conceptions of their population, that a lot of it even has to do with World War II, you know, and sort of this warfare that Hitler led during that time, where he sort of aligned himself with certain ethnies, you know, like in these regions, you know, who were deemed superior from others, you know, like, and so you can, this is a way to break a population up, you know, like, and the question, of course, is always, like, when does this become ungovernable, you know, like, when does it create new borders, and when does it create, you know, political entities that can only be, that will only be dependent, you know, like, and I think this is when you get into sort of grand strategy, like, thinking, and, you know, like, yeah, it's very interesting way to look at things, you know, it's just, like, look at history, look at the history of institutions and what actually happened, you know, you're going to find a lot of really, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, that's kind of the interesting thing, yeah, the thing about secessionist movements and nationalism. So you have these large entities like the United States and the European Union, which are becoming dysfunctional. But on the other hand, you're right that secessionist movements can be used to weaken a country and make them vulnerable to another entity to fill in that power vacuum. I mean, another example is that prior to the Iraq War, there was that neoconservative plan to split up Iraq into a bunch of small countries. So basically a foreign power which wants to weaken its enemy could back a secessionist movement.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what, you know, some people say that the Islamic State, you know, like, is, you know, created precisely for that, you know, like, and yeah. I mean, you know, like I think that's a really, really interesting, like, what is, you know, there are certain, you know, like, cognitive bottom lines, you know, like, and like race, for example, is one of them. So race is a thing that'll always be there in a society. It's always problematic, you know, like, and as long as you know, like, sort of secure material wealth and peace, you know, like, race is not going to be an issue, you know, and we sort of have to fight for that to not become a problem, because, like, once the material wealth is away, you know, like, these things, they can really become problems, you know, like, in a situation of civil war, you know, like, you and I, we're going to feel safer, you know, with white people and the other way around, you know, like, and you know, certain people know that, you know, like, and it's becoming really problematic. Like, what is happening in Europe is insane, because, like, basically these, you know, like, NGOs are bringing in, like, so many people, you know, like, from you know, war zones, and also creating a lot of insecurities for the you know, foreigners that are already there, you know, like, and I think it's really, you know, like, that's why this, like, you know, like, ethno-state discussion, it doesn't go anywhere, because, like, how are you going to tell someone, you know, like, who's, I don't know, like, of whatever Turkish descent, and who's been born in Germany, and his parents have been born there too by now, how are you going to tell this person, you know, that they can't live there, you know, like, I mean, that's a decision that's already been made. You can't just reverse that decision, and or if you try to reverse that decision, you do that, like, at a terrible cost. And I think, you know, like, people are really, who are serious, you know, like, and I'm not talking about abstract online avatar fuckers, you know, like, I'm talking about people who actually, you know, like, have a stake, and, you know, like, have friends, and, you know, like, who, you know, they can't possibly want that. And by the way, by that, I don't mean that I you know, I disagree with people using online avatars. I think that's really important. You know, it's just, I'm saying these things, they carry certain psychological effects, you know, that sometimes I think even surpass the people who are using them.
You worked for an NGO in Berlin. Are you able to comment on some of your observations working for them?
Well, like, look at this, like, this whole NGO sector. I mean, like, I think everybody knows that, you know, that they're called NGOs is ridiculous, you know, because they're funded by, you know, everything that's state, you know, like, and you know how it works. You have to sort of apply at the UN to get this NGO status. So that doesn't mean that, you know, every NGO is bad or that they don't do good things, but it's usually NGOs are very partial, you know, like they do things where political or geopolitical interests guide them, and that's how you have to understand these sort of things. And there's sort of, you know, there are places for spooks, you know, like if you want to find spooks, then you're going to find them in NGOs, you know, and that's not necessarily the fault of NGOs. But, you know, they're sort of, you know, like they're infiltrated there. This is how, you know, like states operate these days. So, like, you look at NGOs, you know, like take away the N and you get an idea of what they are. You know, that they're means, just like companies are, just like great companies or large corporations are, they're means of states to operate abroad without operating as states. That's a good way to look at them. Yeah.
It's illegal to donate to a political party in another country, but with NGOs, because a lot of them have the charitable deduction and they're free from those loopholes, so a billionaire in the United States could finance an NGO in Europe, or a billionaire in Europe could finance an NGO in the Middle East.
Yeah. It always depends on how this works in practice, but, you know, like a lot of these NGOs, they're just funded directly by state organizations or like by state or party foundations, you know, and so this is how these things operate. And for example, Open Society is like extremely big. Like that's not a conspiracy theory. That's just fact, you know, Open Society has its hands in a lot of things, you know, like, I mean, the George Soros Foundation.
It's interesting what you said about the Ukraine, because kind of how that whole nationalist movement, because, I mean, a big part of Soros's agenda in Open Society is basically the destruction of national sovereignty. But there was some connection with the Ukrainian separatists, so, I mean, there's a lot of ironies in that, but they served a vehicle as antagonizing Russia.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, like, it's also interesting because, you know, like, they're sort of, you know, like, there's no hesitancy of American and European Jews of collaborating with neo-Nazis, you know, like that is a thing that's, you know, like also in history that's very ambiguous, you know, like that's a thing that you know, like as a German, it's difficult for me to comment on this because there is you know, like there's certain legal repercussions for me, you know, so I'm gonna leave it at that. But, you know, you can find some very interesting things.
What do you think about the whole theme of productive capitalism versus finance capitalism or speculation?
Well, do you want to comment on that? Or, I mean, it's I think it's, you know, it's an obvious distinction to make, you know, like, and if you've never thought about it this way, you know, like, and capitalism is just like this one monolithic thing instead of, you know, like, instead of sort of a tool, you know, that states use, you know, like, and that, you know, like a tool to organize power, you know, like, then you're an idiot, you know, like, and I think that's the problem with a lot of this capitalist criticism, you know. I hear these things, and this is always like the level of analysis that people go to. It's capitalism, and then, you know, that's how the problem is resolved. And this is obviously, of course, you know, this way you can stay in academia, you know, and you will never have a problem, and you can become a journalist, and you'll never have a problem, and you can make speeches for government foundations and you'll never have a problem because you can always blame capitalism, and everybody blames capitalism because it's like saying, you know, like we blame human nature or something, you know, like, and it means absolutely nothing, you know. It doesn't solving the problem of capitalism doesn't solve the problem of power, you know, like that's a specific organization of power, you know, it's a contemporary one, you know. It's interesting to look at, but, you know, it's more interesting to look at levels of, you know, like actually what I, you know, like you could call that deep sociology, you know, to actually look at the people who are behind this, you know, and look at the interests and look at who these people are. This is where people start getting in trouble, you know.
There's sort of the concept of the reactionary, and that's just kind of a buzzword people throw out there. political adversaries, but the concept of being a reactionary is just wanting to recreate the past or to prevent change. I like the idea of retro politics, which is based on progress but borrowing from the best ideas of the past.
Yeah, exactly. And this is clearly, you know, this is where the zeitgeist is moving to, you know, like architecturally, culturally, like it's all retro-conservative, you know, and it makes perfect sense, you know, if you think about it, because if the future, you know, like is completely territorialized by dystopia, you know, like and you know, like sort of this techno-determinism, then the only way to go is towards the past and look into this, like, you know, like, you know, unexplored territory and borrow from there, you know, like, and you know, that makes all the sense in the world, you know, like, and of course that's going to liberate certain forces, and you have to be careful in what way they're going to be liberated, because, you know, like, once power can't, and I think we're already in this, like, in this phase where, you know, like, I don't think, like, sort of this, like, liberal establishment with its ideas, like, that has become so nightmarish, you know, and so dictatorial that, you know, like, any reasonable person is not gonna, you know, pursue that line of thought anymore. So, you know, like, and I think, like, there will be people who, because there always are people, there will be people who anticipate the backlash against that. And at a certain point, you know, like, they're going to jump on that bandwagon. And, like, I think, you know, like, Emmanuel Macron in France was already a sort of an idea to create a centrist out of nothing, because there were certain, in society, there were certain interesting centrist ideas. And he was sort of, you know, like, using that as a, you know, like, sort of astroturfed, highly capitalized version of that, but already, like, you know, like, saying certain conservative things, you know, like, and I think that's the task of the dissidents will be to observe these people and not give in, you know, because these concessions, they'll only be aesthetic, you know, and they'll possibly be the worst of all worlds, you know, like, sort of the brutality of the right wing, along with the, you know, like, in terms of finance, and, you know, like, with the same hysteria of the left, you know. So and I think that's a future that you'd already have to sort of, you know, you have to take that into account, that is a thing that might happen. And, you know, like, it's really interesting, because that leftist, you know, like, yeah, I'm talking to a lot of people, you know, like, I'm somebody who's always open for debate, like I really am too autistic to sort of, you know, like, not debate things openly, you know, like, and let the better opinion win. Like, I think I'm not attached to my opinions. I mean, maybe I can't see that all, but, you know, like, I'm talking to a lot of people, and I'm talking to, you know, like, you know, like, I'll talk to, like, a lot of people in academia read Jacobite, you know, like, that journal is really interesting, because it plays on a sort of, you know, bourgeois sensibility, you know, like, and it plays on beauty, you know, like, that's a different sort of, you know, like, that's a different sort of aesthetic than, let's say, like Bronze Age pervert. I don't know, are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah, I follow him.
Yeah, which is also, like, this brilliant, of course, like, I don't know, like, vitalist, you know, like, aesthetic, where you play with certain things, you know, like, and there are certain things these people agree on, but, like, there's a lot of academics, like, mainstream, who follow that sort of stuff, you know, like, and they wouldn't tell you about it, or they wouldn't do it, you know, officially, or, like, a lot of, you know, like, to get back to this debate between people who are, like, writing as with their own names, or people who write with avatars, you know, it's like, that's not mutually exclusive at all, man. People have, like, they have their official account, and then they have their, you know, like, sort of trolling and shitposting account, you know, like, and so people exist in these two worlds, you know, like, and they're not mutually exclusive, and they shouldn't be, you know, like, because this is, like, the, you know, they're different types of, you know, like, the avatars are there to birth certain ideas and to put them up for discussion, and the other ones are sort of to actually have the skin in the game and defend them, you know, like, because without that, it just, like, remains this sort of internet sphere, you know, that's divided from everything else. So, like, these things, they're not mutually exclusive. And I warn people against, you know, like, dividing this shit up, you know, like, to, you know, like, to get, pedantic about certain positions, but, you know, then you also have to see, you know, like, if you have a Twitter account that has a, you know, like, significant number of followers, you know, like, at a certain point, you'll feel the political pressure, you know, like, the pressure is out there, you know, like, and if you really observe it, you see people, you know, like, I told that to Doug Lane, and I said, you know, like, you want to understand politics, follow the suicides, follow the lawsuits, you know, like, and I don't mean, like, suicides in general, I mean political suicides, you know, like, when people certainly die, you know, because there is such a thing as, you know, like, political assassinations, even in the West, you just wouldn't hear about them, because they're, of course, not called it that way, you know, but, I mean, you look at David Kelly or whatever, you know, like, the guy from the Weapons of Mass Destruction dossier, and there's a couple of them, you know, like, so...
Yeah,
so
a lot of them were very suspicious. There were cases where the person had no history of depression or any sign of
suicide. exactly, you know, and it's like, it sends a message to everybody who wants to understand, and everybody else just won't, you know, but I think that's interesting, you know, because you meet a lot of people, you know, there's not a lack of intelligence in the world, you know, there's a lack of courage, you know, like, and that's a huge problem, and a lot of people, they're not even aware of that they're being cowards at certain points, you know, because they just, like, they know instinctively, you know, like, to not bite the hand that feeds, you know, like, and I think that's a good way to look at a lot of these things, you know, like, people, yeah, if people were a bit more honest about situating themselves, you know, like, I think we'd have a lot less trouble, you know, like, it would be a lot more honesty, you know, but, you know, egos are involved, and, you know, like, and nobody's free of that, man, like, I'm not, and you're not, and, you know, like, you know how it is.
So with retro politics is about progress, but getting inspiration from a lot of the best ideas in the past and kind of going against this sort of a lot of the negative trends we are now, and that's the same with the aesthetics of retrofuturism. I mean, I'm actually getting to the point where I'm a lot more passionate about aesthetics than politics, because in politics you can discuss these ideas abstractly, and you go back and forth in these arguments of aesthetics, you just create a vision of a kind of society that you'd want to live in, and that can have a lot more powerful effect. But it's also fascinating how a lot of aesthetics are connected to political movements, whether they're capitalism, communism, or fascism, or theocracy. And I think with retrofuturism, it's a... the actual definition of retrofuturism is how the past saw the future. So I think it is inspirational to a new political movement, because it's creating something that's never been implemented that could be. And there definitely are elements of that, but I think it's really important to connect politics with aesthetics and use the aesthetics to create the politics rather than rely on politics.
I don't disagree. Like I'd say at this point it's important, you know, like, I think the question of the question of the city is a really important question, you know, like, you put people into these human cages, you know, like, you're gonna supply undue power to advertising and so on, because people are gonna starve for everything that's beautiful, you know, like, and you set up a certain, you know, like, way of looking at society and so on. So I think that's extremely important, you know. I don't think aesthetics is everything, you know, but at this point it's a lot, you know, like, and, you know, like, maybe, you know, like, power at a certain point will make concessions in terms of aesthetics, and then something else but aesthetics will be important. So, you know, like, you always, I think it's always important to sort of see where you're at in history and what's the thing not to talk about it, because, like, of course these things change, you know, so I don't think you can formulate general rules about this, because, you know, like, that's the you know, like, supremely human category is history, you know, like, and history changes, you know, so it's important to, I think, look at these things not as absolutes, but, you know, like, there's always, like, certain you know, like, you know, ideas that hurt, or you know, like, I actually look at human society, you know, the more I look at it, the more I understand it as a sort of homeostasis, you know, like, it's a sort of movement towards, like, a sort of form that has a lot to do with you know, like the humans themselves, you know, and I think this is only also the way to anticipate it, you know, perhaps like this idea of dialectics, that is something that is actually a sort of, you know, like homeostasis, you know, and it, of course, it takes like extremely varied forms, but, you know, like there is a medium of common sense that people strive towards, you know.
As far as architecture goes, are you more of a traditionalist, or are you also interested in modern and futuristic architecture, both current architecture and the futuristic or retro-futuristic architecture of the 20th century?
Look, man, I mean, I'm European, you know, like, so I have an attachment to the European city, you know, like, I would consider myself, you know, like, you know, perhaps, a new urbanist, like, you know, like, I think that, you know, the James Howard Kunstler, again, and Leon Krier, you know, they're like fantastic architects, and they know a lot about cities and, you know, like how to make human scale cities. And you can learn from everybody, you know, like history doesn't have to end here, you know, like, I mean, the whole architecture of the 19th, like late 19th century, like historicism, that is already a mix of everything that has come before. So that is in a way a retro-conservative architecture, you know, like, and a lot of interesting things have been built there, you know. And, you know, I think also everything that comes afterwards, you know, like, even if you look at the, you know, like, buildings by let's say, Adolf Loos in Vienna, or, you know, the there's, like, some really Wagner, like, I don't know his first name. It's an architect called maybe Otto Wagner or something. And you look at these things in Vienna, and they're already sort of like anticipating the clarity of Bauhaus, but without going all the way, you know, like sort of working with that. I think that's a very interesting architecture, like sort of in between things, like, or Art Deco, like I love, of course, you know. I think that's like extremely, you know, like very, very beautiful. And, you know, like the, you know, these, you can rebuild these things. And of course, like, you know, like, and I encourage architects to think about the principles that have sort of led to those things. And sort of also those, of course, these things, they're a reaction to other architectures, you know, like, and they're playing with different things and they're sort of juxtaposing them, but they also abide by certain principles, and the principles, they usually work, you know, and they make a city beautiful. And I suppose, like, even today people are building, like, interesting things. Like, if you look at the new town in Frankfurt, I just recently saw that, and it's a really interesting combination of modern building styles and sort of, you know, like, old concepts of urbanism, you know. Like, and there's, like a this devastating, ridiculous article in The Guardian just slashing the whole thing, you know. Like,
oh, yeah,
sort of reactionary,
I think,
you know?
Yeah, I think I saw that. So it's new architecture that looks like it could have been there for centuries.
Well, it's sort of like, it's sort of a you know, like a contemporary take on but a contemporary take on the old city, but, you know, like maintaining certain elements and exchanging others. And I think that's a thing that's going to come up, and things that are much more sort of traditional in style will come up, you know. Like, I personally welcome all of these things, and I wouldn't want to make I think may the best thing win, but, like, really the best thing, and not like this, like, you know, like just ill-considered stuff. But then again, there's also, you know, I think that's a real problem. Like there's so many talentless people that have been, you know, like produced by the institutions in the last years, that you really have a problem that there's so many bad architects around, that, you know, you'll just, there'll be a lot of shit built, you know. Like, that's already obvious, you know. And, like, I don't know what the answer to that is. Like, there are certain cities who have these, I've seen that in certain parts of Germany, where, for example, if you're a retailer, you have to adapt your signage to the style that was there before. So you can't just, like, if you're, let's say, what's a big American retailer, like, you know, that's in small stores in the city, 7-Eleven or something?
Oh, yeah.
Is that something you're reading
as well? I live in a city, Santa Barbara, and Santa Barbara is in this kind of a Spanish colonial theme, so there's very, very strict rules about signage. But that's unique.
Exactly.
I mean, most American cities are not like that. It's a unique place.
Yeah, exactly. And I think those are really, really good solutions, you know, like you sort of allow people to work within certain limits. And I think that makes a lot of sense, you know, to think about it this way, you know, like, and that, you know, like people have to think about a sort of aesthetic congruency, you know, like there's the problem of the suburbs, you know, like that has been created in the last years, you know, like, which creates all sorts of like logistics dependencies and problems in the long run, you know, like, so that's a shitty idea. It's based on sort of petrochemicals and like these ideas of mobility. I mean, that's a huge American problem. That's also a problem here in Australia. And they sort of made it into a problem in Germany, where they've started like building up the countryside. It's like aesthetically, it's a crime, but we don't look at things like that anymore. And I think we have to, you know, like, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Perhaps the future of politics is really ruthlessly aesthetic, you know, like, I mean, you know, maybe aesthetic dictatorship is the way, man. I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe that's all that's left, you know. I mean, seriously, like, it's you think about these things, and you know, like, you think the serious of politics is economics, you know, like that's what you know expect, like sort of like coming from a sort of Marxist background, but you know, like, aesthetics is all that people care about.
Yeah, that's why I think that the left I'm using that term again, but I know I shouldn't, but I'll just say it anyway. The left in general has won the culture war because they've embraced aesthetics. The problem with self-described conservatives is that the more corporate-minded are just thinking about profits, so they defend suburban sprawl. And then you also have the more radical traditionalist type that are opposed to any kind of a new aesthetic changes. So they'll critique the modern architecture, but they won't provide something new. They'll just say we should create an exact copy of what we had in the past, and it's we should preserve the architecture of the past. And you mentioned Art Deco. I think that's probably the absolute best example of retro architecture, because it's at the time it was very futuristic, but it also was influenced by ancient styles of the past. And Art Deco, there's Art Deco in Europe, but I associate it more with American cities like New York.
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely, and I mean, it's just a style that holds up, you know. Like it looks good. People will always love it, and I think that's also something to trust, you know. Like there is some sort of there is a popular common sense, and you can take it out of people, you know, like by dumbing a population down. But you know, like, I think people still, they have a sense for beauty, you know, and that's something you can't like entirely disregard. Like for example, like this architect Peter Eisenman, you know, like, I mean, I think you know, like, it's like this completely, you know, like, builds these horrible things. He built the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, like, which is like really that's such an ugly, like, you know, like that's really, you know, like,
I heard
probably
the one
like a ruin
by Libeskind, but not that one.
Is that Libeskind? No, I think it's Eisenman.
Oh yeah.
No, Libeskind built the Jewish Museum in
Berlin, right.
Which is also terrible, by the way, you know. It's like they're both really, really bad architects, you know.
As far as modern architecture, I do like the new Bahnhof in Vienna, if you've seen it.
The Bahnhof in Vienna.
The Bahnhof, yeah.
The main train station?
Yeah, the one that's mostly glass.
It's terrible, man. I don't like it at all. You know, it's one of the most depressing areas in Vienna, if you ask me. But hey, man, you know, that's why we can argue, man. Look, it was interesting talking to you, man. Like, I'm, unfortunately, I have to go. But yeah, I mean, let me know how that goes. Let me know, like, you know, I'm not a very congruent speaker, you know, so I drift off into many different directions. I hope your listeners will forgive me. Yeah,
Nicholas Hausdorff, it has been an excellent show. So many interesting topics. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thanks, man. Talk to you later. Bye.